I think we're about ready to get started. It's 3 o'clock high. My name is Jeff Fritz. I'm a program manager on the .NET team, and we're going to talk about .NET framework tips, tricks, and improvements. And I'm going to leave the slides behind because I want to show you just real live demos, okay? I'm going to get right in, get our hands dirty, and start working with all the cool stuff that we can do with .NET framework in 2017. Because .NET framework, it's mature. It comes with every version of Windows. You know you're going to have a reliable base framework, a base class library, on every Windows machine that you log into. You don't have to do this .NET Core package restore stuff. You've got a .NET framework. So let's go take a look at some of the cool stuff we can do with the new .NET framework. So I'm going to start off by getting out of PowerPoint. First thing I want to show you is that, of course, .NET framework lives in C, Windows, Microsoft.NET. And we're under framework. And of course, we have all these different framework versions, and it stops at 4.0. Why does it stop at 4.0? Because we started overlaying versions of .NET framework with 4. And if I click into this, right, and I start looking at some of my favorite DLLs in here, my personal favorite, I'm going to go find System Web DLL, and I'm going to do a properties on that, and I look at details, you can see I have version 4.7 installed. .NET Framework version 4.7 came with the Windows 10 Creators Update. So if you installed the latest version of Windows 10, it's on your machine. It's on your mother-in-law's machine if she installed all the latest updates when they were promoted to her as well. Okay? Which is kind of weird when you think about it. We have a System Web DLL running on some of these folks' machines that aren't necessarily doing web development. But that's part of the .NET Framework. It's on every machine. You can rely on it being there. Now, .NET Framework 4.7 was made available initially just for Windows 10, but we have released an install that is also available for Windows 7 Service Pack 1 and Windows Server 2008 R2 Service Pack 1 and later versions. We do them real well. Okay, we like to name things with lots of extensions. But that's great that System Web DLL is here and it's 4.7, but how do I actually get the tools into Visual Studio to use it? This is where the Visual Studio installer, especially Visual Studio 2017 installer, makes things so much easier for you to use, develop with, and come back into so you can enhance your development experience. So let's get things ready with the Visual Studio installer, and you can see I've actually got two different versions of Visual Studio on my machine. You can always put down multiple versions of Visual Studio 2017, multiple SKUs, side by side, if you qualify for them. So I have the preview install for Enterprise 2017, and then the full released version, the 15.2 version of 2017, sitting here. I'm going to click Modify on, I choose this one. Because I want to show you that it's real easy to come in here and light up .NET 4.7. Wrong button. There's my zoom. .NET 4.7 SDK and the .NET 4.7 SDK targeting pack. All right. I don't have them installed in this version of Visual Studio, but I do have them installed in the other one. So they're side by side with different components installed and available here for me to use. So you can click through that, light it up, and it'll bring those down and install on your version of Visual Studio. When you have that installed, you can now start to look at things like this, right? And we saw this demo earlier today when we were taking a look at Windows Forms and high DPI support, right? This is the thing where when we run our Windows Forms application for .NET Framework 4.6, it's going to come up and it's going to look hideous, right? In particular, I mean, look at that calendar control. The list box is wonky. My load data button is in the wrong place. It works, sure, but it's not that high DPI experience that I expect. And in the demo this morning, we saw real quick, they just changed the version of .NET Framework, and it just worked. there's just a little setting or two that you need in order to light this up, and I want to make sure that you see that, and I want to show you some of the other configuration options that you, as the programmer, can do to manipulate the high DPI experience inside of Windows 10. So let me close this, and I'm going to flip this, of course, over to 4.7. Yep, I changed my target framework. Go ahead and restart. And of course it works, right? And we get it lining up the way we expect it. What I want you to see is that inside of app config, this little bit right here, right? I went in just a little far. System Windows Forms Application Configuration section, DPI Awareness per Monitor V2. You have to drop this in there so that Windows 10 knows that it needs to be aware of the DPI and how to check that so that it does do the scaling properly. I'm using a Lenovo Yoga here that has a 4K display, and that's why I'm getting this little bit of display artifact, right, the weirdness in .NET 4.6.1. So if you've got a laptop or a machine with a 4K display, you got a really cool Mac laptop, you'll want to do this also when you're running Windows over there so you get the high DPI. Now that's just the first setting. The other setting you need to flip is actually hiding here in App Manifest. So you need to actually tell Windows that this is a Windows 10 operating system supported application. You drop this in there and it'll appropriately put those last pieces in place so that it will handle the higher DPI. Now, with those in play, you saw what it does. It's very, very simple. It just flips everything. I didn't have to change any extra code. But if you want to write some extra code, if you want to go in and do some extra things when DPI changes, so for example, on my desktop setup at home, when I plug my Yoga into my external displays are only 1920 by 1080. Only 1920 by 1080. They're not the high def, the 4K, right? They're high def. So when I drag a window from my laptop over onto that external display, it does this weird dance because the DPI changes. You can do things to handle what happens when the DPI changes. So let me show you inside of, yes. When you are on a form that is being enhanced with high DPI, you have this code that you can execute, you can intercept at this point. You could say, on DPI changed for the form, go do this, right? Maybe you want to put up some sort of a spinner or something while the resolution of your form is changed. But this is an option for you to work with. Similarly, if you're writing your own controls, right, because I don't know anybody who doesn't love to write their own Windows Forms controls. There's nobody here from one of the control vendors, is there? Okay. So if you're writing your own control, there are other events in here that you can trap on the control so you can intercept and do different things to your control when the DPI changes. And this is what we've done on most of the controls that are available in Windows Forms. Just about every control that comes in the box with Windows Forms, you can intercept before the DPI changes, for the parent, after the parent item changes, and then rescale constants for DPI so you can go in there and you can do different things to your control to make sure that it's laid out properly when the scale changes. So as we saw in the demo this morning, it can be as simple as just change the version and version of .NET Framework and the application works. But if you want to take a little bit more control, here's some of the things that you can do with your code to take advantage of those options. All right. Let me look at my notes here. Next thing I want to show you, I want to talk a little bit about some of the enhancements we made to ASP.NET. That's the full 4.7 version that we have available. So let me close this one. I'm going to roll over to my ASP.NET demo. See, I had two Visual Studios open, and
my machine reset on me. It closed and reopened. There we go. All right.
So what we've done with ASP.NET 4.7 is we've started to add additional features to allow you to take better advantage of asynchronous processing back and forth from your external providers as you're writing your code. That's a lot of back and forth language stuff. What the heck does that actually mean? So when you make requests to go get things like session or output cache from a SQL server, there is thread lock while it's waiting for that I/O processing to happen. What we've done is, starting in .NET Framework 4.6.2, we added APIs so that you could have asynchronous requests from the database for session and output cache. Starting with 4.7, we've actually made providers available for SQL Server so you can make those asynchronous requests. So if we take a look at this application, let me just get my... Yeah, we're fine. Let me cancel this out. And I need to... So some of the scenarios where you might see a real problem with this also is around JavaScript asynchronous queries to your website. So if you have a bunch of JavaScript that you're running or that folks have built clients that are connecting to your website and fetching data, you may see problems where they're blocking and waiting for data to load because when session is requested, by default, it's read-write. That is, it's going to read session and get a read lock, an exclusive read lock, until it's done reading session, working with session, and then writing it back out. And I have, let me turn that off on line 29. I am going to just remove session altogether. Now, there it goes. So what I've done to kind of help demonstrate some of the advantages of this is I've written a little page that on the default, there we go, I've got four counters, all right? I've allocated four labels for these, a little span called first, second, third, and fourth. And I just wrote a little bit of jQuery to go out and hit a page called counter ASPX. And it's going to try and hit this counter page. And each time that it hits it and gets data back, I'm going to update one of those counter locations on the screen. So hopefully, this fires through quickly, and I'm able to see some results from it. So I already have it out here. I'm going to click Start Counting. And this is running very quickly at this point because there's no session, and everything's running in memory. Okay? Session is not reading and writing. It's not locking. But it is doing read-write locking, a little bit of exclusive interaction, even though it's in memory, right? It's not spending the time to go out and get stuff from the database, but I am going to have a little bit of contention as this is running. So let me close that. We don't need that. And I'm going to go back over here, stop this. Now, if I introduce the packages for this, and let me show you what the packages look like for this functionality, because we've moved these features out into NuGet packages. Here they are over here. So, gosh, the nouns just get added on to the end of these package names. Microsoft, ASP.NET, I'll show you, let's talk about the bottom two. Session state module, and SQL session state provider async. So these are the two features, the two packages you need. When you install them, they'll automatically update your web config so that it's using this asynchronous session state provider for SQL Server. Now, in addition to that asynchronous session state being available to you, there are some other things that we make available as well, such as the ability for you to turn off that read-write lock so that it turns into last request wins when it's interacting with your website. So consider if you have some sort of a dashboard or some sort of a SPA-like framework that's running on the HTML of your application, and folks are making requests, and there's maybe four or five requests all coming at the same time to your website. Instead of it blocking for all of those, you know you're not updating session. You know you're not doing something that's going to be critical if they come in out of order and update session. So let's just let them go through together. So for any one session ID, we can let them go through and request and work with session at the same time. And we've also provided the ability for you to throttle those requests. So let me turn these back on for session. And I'm actually going to push. Let me turn on session state here. And that's actually going to go to SQL Local DB. I'm actually going to change that one. Because I want it to go to my SQL Azure. I'm going to connect out and actually get session from Azure. The other piece to this that you need to configure, there it is, and that we will insert automatically for you is a session HTTP module. And this is because when you're processing things asynchronously for session, it may come back and not be on the same thread as the request. And we need to make sure that session gets back into the HTTP context appropriately, so that when the next thread picks up on the web form or in your MVC processing, that it properly has session loaded and available for processing. So we need to make sure that we can insert it back into context there. So those are the two pieces just to turn this on. Up here, I've got my connection strings, but these are the two things right here that I particularly want you to see. Request queue limit per session and allow concurrent requests per session. So if you turn on the second one, allow concurrent requests per session, it'll allow those reads and writes to happen simultaneously for a given session ID. So you can have 4, 5, 6, up to whatever my queue limit is, request and work with session concurrently for the same session ID. Now, I tell you this because we've had a number of customers who went and did things like put security on all of the files on their ASP.NET website, and each one of those security checks comes through and requests session and then hits a database to check to ensure that those folks are valid users. Well, for each one of those files that they're requesting to get session for, and I'm talking things like JavaScript files, favicon.ico, okay, images. Images you may want to secure, I get it. But JavaScript files, CSS files, they were checking and securing those things, and every request for those, and we all know in modern web now, you see a dozen, two dozen JavaScript files on a web page, and every single one of those was blocking waiting for session. So if you turn this on, you can allow through that number of requests simultaneously. So let's let this run. Now this time it's going to connect out and it's going to work with data in the SQL Azure database. Now, the other thing that we've done with this provider, the last thing, and it's the thing that I always forget, and I'm actually forgetting it for this demo, but I want to make sure you know about it, is, you know that reg SQL statement, ASP.NET reg SQL? Look at that, I forgot something already. Unable to connect to SQL database. But you know that reg SQL command you have to run? We've actually we've removed the requirement for you to submit and run that statement. So let me check here. Add client IP. Yeah. Try that again. There we go. So now I'm connected out to my database. So I was saying about the ASP.NET reg SQL, right? You always had to remember to run this whenever you installed and configured a new session database or a new output cache database. So to finish what I was saying about that, I always would forget that statement, and I would always go to MSDN documents to try and remember, oh, what are the switches I need to run? Because I need to set up session. I need to set up all my providers' tables appropriately. And it was never convenient, right? I ended up bookmarking the MSDN article, forgetting that it was in my bookmarks and having to search for it every time, even though it was right there in my browser bookmarks, because nobody uses bookmarks anymore, right? So why do we have to remember to do that? If you set up and connect to ASP.NET, your ASP.NET database with a user that has schema create and table create authorization, it'll just create that stuff for you without you having to build it. So that's pretty cool. Now that this is loaded, I'll start it counting, and it's going to actually pick up speed here a little bit and start rumbling through, and you can actually see it's updating the counters simultaneously in some places because it's coming back faster and it's not locking properly actually on the server side. So you get better speed, better throughput when you use these new providers. If you have a web application that you're running with SQL Session Provider, I encourage you to check out these new providers because you're going to get the async capabilities. It's going to allow you to pass things through faster. And we've also done some things with the SQL team to optimize access to the database. So if your database has things like memory tables available, we'll take advantage of that, and we will use those faster access tables for sessions, which really should be temporary in nature. So that's a little bit about some of the things we've done with ASP.NET. You can find information about the provider and output cache on the web dev blog. This is blogs.msdnmicrosoft.com. I'll give you a link in the notes at the end. I have a bit.ly link for you. Here, I'll even cheat and let you see what it is. ASP Core 2P1 will get you right to that blog post. Okay, bit.ly ASP Core 2P1. All right. Let's take a look at some other features that we've recently added. .NET Standard 2.0 support. So, of course, if you saw the keynote, if you saw my earlier session about ASP.NET Core, we have included support for .NET Standard. Now, .NET Standard 2 is, of course, in preview mode, and it's, right, it's this new feature, it's this new contract that you can use to write a class library that abstractly refers to one of the .NET frameworks, not just .NET Framework 4.7, 4.6.1, but also targets .NET Core and Xamarin. So when you build an application for .NET Standard, let me open up, I'm going to go to that same zip that I was working with earlier, that sample that was doing the compression. There we go, this one. So this is the sample that Scott showed earlier, I showed during the .NET Core demo, where we were working with a .NET Standard library. There it is. So this is .NET Standard 2. This is a class library called Compressor 2. I'm going to open up Solution Explorer, and I want you to see this is a .NET Framework 4.6.1 console app, and when I manage my packages on this, right, so I have .NET Standard Library, .NET Framework. This is the shim package that you need to install if you want to build a .NET Standard project and have it referenceable from your .NET Framework applications. So any .NET Framework application, that's WPF, Windows Forms, console applications, services, ASP.NET 4.7, 4.6.1 applications, they can all reference libraries that are built with this shim applied inside of that project, not the standard project that you're building, not the class library you're building, but the actual WinForms or ASP.NET project needs to have this project added in, and it'll just work. Okay, it's not adding megs and megs and megs of DLLs. It's just bringing down a little contract information that it's going to use to help reroute those references appropriately back and forth to the .NET Framework capabilities. All right. So when you have the .NET standard libraries and you're starting to build those, and you want to know, will these things work with .NET Framework? You need to look at something that we call the .NET Standard Portability Analyzer. And this is an extension you can install into Visual Studio, and I think it works in Visual Studio 2015 as well. But tools, extensions, and updates, and I have it already installed. It's right here, .NET Portability Analyzer. And you can see, we just updated it, what is that, last week? We pushed out a new version of it. Install this. It's very small. It only lights up when you actually call for it to be run inside of your application. So you can take this, and inside of, I'll run it on my, let me run on this .NET standard. Let's run it on this one. So I can go to Analyze Project Portability, or let me show you what the settings look like. Now what this is going to do, it's going to show me I can choose all kinds of different formats to output in. Everybody loves Excel. But then you can choose what target platforms do you want to see, do you want to verify that this can work with? Okay? And you can go through and choose, is it compatible with 1.6? Is it compatible with 4.6.2? Is it compatible with Silverlight 2? Is anybody still supporting Silverlight? Nobody in the room has raised their hand. Thank you. Okay, good. I was going to say, because that ship's long sailed, all right? We've moved on from Silverlight. There's your Windows Phone stuff, Xamarin. So you can check to make sure that your stuff will work with these things. So I'm going to say OK. So it's real easy to right-click and analyze project portability. It's going to go through, compile, and it's going to show me in just a second here. It should show me. Where is it? Let me try running it on this one. There we go. Analyzing compatibility. There we go. Open report. So it shows me I'm 97.44% there on .NET Standard, and I can drill into details, and it shows you here are the things that you need to change in order to make sure that you are fully supported. Assemblies that it wasn't able to find and resolve, no big deal. You can drill down and go analyze those things. But you get this nice cohesive report. It's a simple extension that you can add into Visual Studio to run. This is an alpha. Check it out. Let us know what you think of it, because we think this is going to be a big help for you when you start looking forward and trying to figure out what do I want to do with my application? What pieces can I make .NET Standard? Because I want to build an iPhone app with some of that business logic that I've already built and still reuse that and continue to use it in my WinForms app that folks use out on a call floor or my accounting friends use, okay? So check this out. Let us know what you think. There's a lot of things that we think we can do in this space, but we want to hear how you would use this. What makes sense for you in order to make this more valuable, okay? All right. I want to show you one of my favorite features in .NET Framework in Visual Studio that's available for .NET Framework 4.7, and that is, where is it? Got to find the appropriate demo here. Here we go. My project's gone missing. Where'd it go? VS 2017 new features. It's so new that my sample is gone missing from my machine. Neat. All right. Wow. All right, I wasn't expecting that. That's, is it here? Ah, there it is. All right. Wrong folder. This one. Would really stink if I tried to show you a sample and the sample was completely gone.
So one of the new features that we have that's available for Visual Studio 2017 is called live unit testing. So who writes unit tests with their code? Okay, this side of the room really likes unit tests. So you guys, I don't know, quality. All right, so I've got probably about 60, 70% of the room is writing unit tests. So when you're writing unit tests, right, everybody loves going up here to the test, run, all tests, and waiting for the MS test thing to start up, compile my code, run, and eventually tell me. The test only took 14 milliseconds, but it took, you know, 5, 10 seconds for it to actually start up, right? Live unit testing is this new feature that you can add in while you're coding, and this comes on the Enterprise edition of Visual Studio. You can go test, live unit testing, start. And we'll see in a second here that my unit tests, which are sitting here, I have one here that's failing, it's sitting here. And this is a bank account, very simple application. It's just going through and it's running these tests to see does it properly debit and credit appropriately from the account. And I could see that it's failing. I can go over to my other classes and I could see the red X's are lines that were executed that didn't pass a test. At least one test, maybe multiple tests, but they failed at least one. And the minus lines indicate these weren't executed at all by a unit test during the run. So there's some areas where you may want to be able to create some additional unit tests to gain coverage, but I can scroll through here and I can see all the areas where it didn't run properly. And in particular, you can see where, for sample reasons, I marked this was incorrect. I'm going to change this, and without saving, you can see there's a little clock next to my X's. It's come through, and it's indicated the test now passed. So now I can save, check in my code, and I've got some comfort, I've got some knowledge now that I've updated and I've got properly passing unit tests inside my application. So that when continuous integration fires because I've checked in my source code, I can be sure that the source code will be checked out and unit tested properly on VSTS, Jenkins, whatever your CI system might be. And of course, right, I can still, if I'd like, go test, run, all tests, wait, and it comes back properly. Now, this does support MS test, XUnit, and NUnit. I prefer NUnit. Some other folks really like XUnit, and other folks like MS test. We support all three. Okay, you can use all of them very easily with this, and you don't have to add additional features into this. You just need to add in your appropriate unit test framework and the shims necessary to get it to run inside the Test Explorer. So I know XUnit has an additional thing that you install to make it run with Test Explorer, and then you can right-click and turn on live unit testing. So very easy to start up and get running for your application. Now the other thing I want to show you while I was going through here, I've got these things, right? And this is because some friends on my dev team, they don't like seeing explicit types when we declare variables in C#. Right? And some people get into pretty good arguments over this. Not as bad as VI versus Emacs, but pretty good ones. In this case, what we've done is we've actually set this to be a warning, right? That you're not supposed to be doing this. So I can flip this and have it automatically fixed for me. And there's other ways that I can come through, right? So if I do control period, I can actually also say fix all occurrences of this problem in the document, in the project, in the solution. And that kind of, when I use one of those other ones that says fix all of them across the entire solution, that feels like one of those things when somebody goes into their project, they open it up, and they do that right click on the using statements, and they say optimize usings across the entire solution. And all of a sudden, all those grayed out usings are just removed, and they check in a pile of files, a huge pull request, and all they did was optimize the using statements. You know, it's
I want to see a little bit more value than that when I go through and check these in. So personally, I like to do this on really a file-by-file basis when I submit my commits to source control. But these things here where it's coming back and it's upset about using var, that's actually configured through something called code style. So this is available in all versions of Visual Studio. So if I take a look, there are these options that you can set for different things about the way that you write code. If you scroll down here, you can see for built-in types, it's going to mark those things as an error, and that's where I got the red squiggle. When the variable type is apparent, it's a warning. Elsewhere, it's a suggestion, okay? And there's all kinds of things in here that you can have it suggest, and then it'll give you that quick control period access to be able to refactor and make your code align with the way that your team wants code to be formatted. Now, this is nice. This is settings inside of Visual Studio. But if I want to take my settings and make them available to everyone on the team, I don't want it to be something that's a Visual Studio settings file that I want to pass around. I'm going to use something that I can check in and it follows my source code around. So we've actually adopted the editor config syntax. Now, editor config is a standard. It's a standard format so that you can kind of enforce some of these preferences around file and file formatting in your project. Like, for example, for all files, so we've got the star up at the top, on line 4, indent style is tab, because tab is the proper way to format your source code. I'm from Philly. You're not allowed to boo me, okay? We know about boo birds in Philly, let me tell you. All right, so and then if it's XML, our indent type is space. Somebody's going to need to get a little throat punch on that one because that should be tabs. But we've extended these. Those are standard format things up at the top. You can filter by different file types. You can set different things about how you want to format your code. But then down the next section there, the star CS, that's where we've started extending and added things that Visual Studio knows how to enforce, C-sharp style, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these settings actually are going to take precedence over what's in Visual Studio. And this is actually applied hierarchically. So let me show you. This file is sitting inside of this project. So it only applies to the contents of this project and not the contents of the other project. The other project gets the default settings from Visual Studio. Similarly, if there were folders inside this project, all files in those folders and their descendants would all have these rules applied to them. Make sense? Now, this looks fine and dandy, these rules that are sitting here, but how do you know the keywords for this? You could go to www.editorconfig.org, I think it is, and actually look up what some of the rules are. But we have an extension that you can use and actually get the list of available options that you can set here. All right. So I can grab things like this, and it knows that that's supposed to be a Boolean, so I can choose that appropriately. Star VB, I'm just making up there. I'm just trying to show off another group. So if I come up here to this, so it knows true or false. Well, if I say true, now it tells me I can choose the appropriate error level for it to enforce. Easy to use. And this is another extension I want you to be aware of. Let me show you extensions and updates. This is the editor config language service, if you want to use that. And those things that aren't Visual Studio enforced on the languages, those other items that you saw around indent type and other formatting. Let me go back to that, right? Indent type, tab width, end of line, carriage return line feed. Those things will actually be picked up and enforced in other editors that aren't as IDE-centric as Visual Studio. Things like, I believe Sublime enforces this. Even Visual Studio Code will enforce this because it's a text editor, and these are text editor types of enforcements. Now, this is a text editor enforcement. This isn't something that will be triggered and analyzed during a build on your CI server. That's where you may want to get involved some things still around code formatting along the lines of FXCOP. Okay? So that's a little bit about formatting and some of the tricks you can do to help enforce a standard. Let's take a look at .NET Framework 4.7 and C# 7 features. Let me go to my C# 7 samples. Nope. So if you've seen some of the C# 7 sessions at the seashore, there's a new feature called tuples, we'll call it tuples, inside of C# 7. And right, you can return values that are of this value tuple type. You don't really need to declare it. You specify the names of the various things that are coming out, and you can work with that easily coming out of C# 7. Well, inside of .NET Framework 4.7, the value tuple is now part of the default framework. It's now part of what comes with it. You no longer have to add this as a package, something that gets added on to your project if you're working on an older version of .NET Framework. If you're working on 4.6.1, 4.6.2, 4.5, you can actually use the language feature natively right there in 4.7 because it comes with the framework. So that's nice. That's a nice little convenience for you. Now, we also showed that we had all kinds of updates for our documentation. So all the documentation around C#, around .NET Framework, right, that's all on docs.microsoft.com. And if we choose .NET, right, here's all the great documentation that we have. Let me go to the API reference. And you can see we now have 4.7 available here. You can also choose your favorite .NET Framework and search along and bring back the appropriate versions of things for your needs, right? Whatever it is that you want to find, we have 4.7 and all the features here, and this is all open source, right? So if I go find something like dataset, I can click edit, and now I'm actually in the source code, .NET docs on GitHub. Right, we host the source code for this stuff on GitHub. And you can see, here's everything that was written about it. So if there's something over here, maybe you find a typo. Maybe you find something that you can improve. Maybe there's some remarks or something that you feel could be better explained. Click that edit button. Submit a pull request. You're going to go through the same evaluation as our document writers. And you know what? If you have something that's a valuable contribution to our documents, we'll accept it and we'll publish it and we'll give you credit on the Microsoft documents. That's pretty cool. That's a neat little claim to fame. Okay? So don't think that the documents that are out here are perfect and that they are not going to change, because we are changing them. We are enhancing them. We want to make sure that they contain the best material they can. And if you, as members of our community, think that there is a way that they can be improved, send us a pull request. We're more than happy to check them out. Last thing that I want to show you is that we now support Docker for all of our .NET framework applications. So let's start a new application. So I'm going to go back to C# web. And I'm going to pull this down and select 4.6.1. Dev intersection Docker. And I'm going to choose web forms, because web forms rules. We're going to open that up, because we got the default web forms application. And we're going to put this inside of a Docker container. Now, on this machine, this is Windows 10 with the container configuration option added on to the operating system. I've also installed Docker for Windows. You can see the little whale down here. Docker is running. If I right-click on that, it says switch to Linux containers. It's saying switch to Linux containers because I've already got Windows containers installed. So I've got Windows containers up and running. This is my default .NET Framework 4.6.1 project. I'm going to right-click on this, and I can choose Add. I can choose. Come on. There we go. Docker support. This comes in the box with Visual Studio 2017. You don't need to extend anything. It's just there. Oh, look, and it's giving me the 4.6.2 image. Now, I want 4.6.1. All right. What it does when you want to add Docker to your project, it actually adds the Docker file here along with a Docker ignore so it can configure stuff so that it only brings in the files that it compiles and publishes to Docker. And it also adds this other project down here that says Docker Compose. If we look at the Docker Compose file, very simple. It's going to create an image and point to the Docker file that we just referenced. My debug start button here flips and says run Docker, so I'm going to actually launch that. Let's take a look at the output here. And what did I break? Fine. There it goes. So now it's building and actually starting Docker. And if you know anything about how Docker runs, when it's building the container image, it goes through these steps that you can see here in my output window. You're seeing the exact same steps that are running if you were to be running Docker from the command line to compile and build your images. So it's going through, it successfully built it, it's now going to get ready and launch it, and you can see it's run Docker inspect, and it's actually found that the image is listening on this internal IP address, 172.24, blah, 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 blah. It's now contacting the server to start debugging, because I'm going to actually debug into that Windows server thread. And that process will start up here in just a second. Now I'm in debug mode, right? I've got the orange bar on the bottom of my Visual Studio. And there's my ASP.NET application. And you see it's on 172.24.496. Not some 10.1.1 IP address. It's actually something internal to my machine. And it's being run and hosted by Docker. Right? There is dev intersection Docker. Let me remove the other one. Do that one more time. There it is. So it's been running for about a minute. All right. And if we look at my images, dev intersection Docker, there it is. And it's that large because we're actually bringing down all of Windows Server Core, installing IIS, and then we're putting your application on top of that. So it's running almost the exact same set of configuration as if you were installing and running on a VM somewhere out in the cloud or in your own data center. But instead, it's running as a process here on my machine, thinner, lighter, and faster for me to interact with. Right? I've got a saved configuration that I can start up and knock down very easily. And that debug capability is actually wired up all the way through into Docker. So if I put my breakpoint there, I'm over here, I've refreshed, and I'm in Visual Studio, and I'm connected and stopped at a breakpoint on the Windows Server Core instance inside of Docker hosted on my machine. That's pretty cool, right? This is a way for us to now to publish our application configuration as software, as code, so that it can be reused and loaded easily. It's going to minimize the need for that sticker that says works on my machine that you keep giving to the folks in QA and in production, because you're going to be able to write and use, lift and shift your application into Docker containers, have them used in production in your QA environment easily. All right. So I've gone through and shown a bunch of tips and tricks about how this stuff works. Are there any questions? Anything at all? I've gone through and covered a lot. Nothing. Amazed. Yes, in the corner.
Is the Docker using
is Docker using the Hyper-V version or using the in-process? So the Windows containers use the Hyper-V, not the in-process. So it loads up quickly. It's actually hiding in the background there from you. So, good question. Anything else? No. Yes? Live unit testing is, yes, it is only available on the enterprise SKU, the enterprise version of Visual Studio. If you have an MSDN license, you probably have access to the enterprise version of Visual Studio, especially the enterprise version of MSDN. There was another question. Yes? So the let me rephrase so that people on the recording and the people streaming can hear. The question is, we're starting a new project here, and I'm in starting with a class library here. Well, I've got a class library that says .NET Framework. And I've got other class library things here that look like all these other different things. Which one should I use if I want to be able to get maximum reuse out of this with my current application architecture and be set up better for the future? Does that encapsulate your question pretty well? Cool. I would recommend trying a .NET standard class library at this point. Try to use a .NET standard class library 1.6. Don't go to 2.0 just yet because it's a preview, unless there's something specific in .NET Standard 2.0 that you need to try and use. But I would try and use 1.6 because it's full compatible with .NET Framework 4.6.1 and .NET Core 1.0. Okay, you'll get good compatibility into both of those frameworks. And if you're building strictly business logic, you're not doing any sophisticated processing, stuff that needs to touch registry or the file system, you should be able to interact and get a really nice experience with that you can reuse in both of those places, and then possibly even in the future if you go to build an Android application or an iOS application. Okay? Any questions over here? I've had a couple over that way. Yes, sir, in the front. So the question is, when you look at Docker for Windows right now, it has this option that says switch to Linux containers, or if you're running with Linux containers, it says switch to Windows containers instead. The question is, can you only run Windows containers or Linux containers, or can you run both Windows and Linux containers at the same time on Windows 10? You can only, right now, you can only run one or the other. There's been a couple folks that are trying to figure out what's the best way so that we can do both, because it'd be really nice to be able to stand up some things like a WCF service in a container and be able to build that .NET Core application that needs to connect into it and be able to do a cool debugging thing all at the same time. So there are folks that do want to see that thing happen, but for right now, where we are with the tools, it's one or the other. Cool. Yes, over here in the middle. So the question is the tooling support for Docker files and Docker Compose, is it strictly a Windows thing, or will it also work with Linux? So I'm going to just real quick start up a new ASP.NET Core application. I'm going to choose Web API because I don't really want to wait for it to build all the UI stuff. And I'm going to go into Solution Explorer. Let's right-click. I'm right-clicking. Now I've got the circle of patience. Somebody's for loop is running in the background. All right, there we go. I'll try this again. Add Docker support. And now because I'm in .NET Core, I can choose. Do I want Linux or do I want Windows? And it'll grab and specify my Docker configuration appropriately. Now, of course, when we're in .NET Framework, we're going to run on Windows. We can't run on Linux. But when we're in .NET Core, we do have this choice. So good question. Thank you. Yes, another question down front. Yes, live unit testing. So the question is, will that coverage down the left side, right, the X's, hyphens, and plus, checks, will that display regardless of the test framework that we're using? Yes, it's the same user interface display regardless of the test framework you choose to use. We make that available for everyone. All right, I am just about out of time. I'm going to be available afterwards outside. I'll be sure to hang out. Thanks so much for coming out. Those of you streaming at home, thanks so much for watching. I really appreciate it. My name is Jeff Fritz. And there's those resources for you.